But it seems to me that the question you need to ask is, was it honourable? Mm. Was it decent? And when it all appeared in the newspapers, the great British public thought, well, this wasn't honourable.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Welcome to The Profile, where we sit down with a different Christian each and every week and hear something of their story. This week's episode is a little bit different, and that's because we wanted to pay tribute to the late Lord Richard Harries. He was a former Bishop of Oxford. He was a prolific broadcaster, and you could hear him quite often here on Premier Christian Radio. And so what we've done is we've gone into the archive and dug out a past interview that Lord Richard Harries gave to us here at Premier on the Inspirational Breakfast Show, hosted by John Pantry and Esther Higham. And so you're going to hear that in a moment's time. If you're not already a subscriber to Premier Christianity, then that's the magazine that sponsors this show and brings it to you every week. I'm the editor of that publication. Do check out our latest subscription offers available right now at premierchristianity.com. Without any further ado, let's listen in to this week's episode. This was recorded on the Inspirational Breakfast Show, so it's a little bit different to normal, but we wanted to pay tribute to the late Lord Richard Harries.
What lies underneath our political system? And our next guest is someone who's very well equipped to talk us through that. He's a man of many talents, a former bishop and now a life peer, a revered academic who's written many best-selling books, including C.S. Lewis, The Man and His God. He's also published an enlightening book which explores the role of Christianity in politics. We're, of course, talking about Lord Richard Harries, who joins us now in the studio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And you've already given us permission to call you Richard. So
yes, absolutely.
Thank you very much indeed for that.
Did we leave anything off the list? Probably lots of things.
Well, I think my problem, as soon as I hear that kind of question, I want just a new law, but I want to wave a magic wand, a magic wand somehow to close the gap between the increasingly rich and the increasingly marginalised. I mean, that's the major problem, I think, affecting the world at the moment between developing countries, our countries, and also within our own country.
Is it a magic wand that's needed, or are there some... it sounds like it's such a huge problem, of course. It feels like the only thing that could do it would be a miracle. Are there small things the small policy changes we should be making so that happens?
Well, I do think it is the role of, given the fact that we have a market economy, and we all now, I think, believe in a market economy, there's no real difference between any of the three major parties on that. And that means that people are in the market, as it were, to make a go of their lives. Now, not everybody can. A lot of people are left at the wall. And I think when we think of government, we think of the government's responsibility to look after the common good, the good of the whole. And therefore, I do think that government always has a particular responsibility to look after those people who are pushed to the wall, the most vulnerable, those who can't sort of compete as strongly as others in the marketplace.
Mm. In your book, Faith in Politics, with the all-important question mark at the end of it, you've taken a look at the roots of democracy, human rights, the rule of law, shown that Christian principles underpin them all. Does this give you hope that British politics can be given a new lease of life?
Well, behind this book is the realisation that there's not only a widespread distrust of politicians now, which is terrible, very unhealthy for our national life, but there's actually, I think, a real indifference to our political values and political institutions. We tend to take them for granted, don't we, the fact that we live in a democracy, that we have the rule of law. But so many countries in the world, there's no real rule of law, there's no democracy. And I want people to wake up to the fact that these values and institutions that we take for granted are really valuable. And then secondly, I argue that they weren't just invented in the 17th century by secular thinkers. Actually, they're deeply rooted in our Christian faith and our Christian culture. So I tried to show what the Christian roots are of values like equality and liberty and our system of democracy and the rule of law.
Mm. One thing that fascinates me, that the odd occasion that I've been to the Houses of Parliament, is how, you know, that there are biblical references all over it. I mean, in the centre of the lobby, you've got that huge mosaic with "Unless the Lord builds the house, the labourers labour in vain." I mean, it's in the fabric of the building too, isn't it?
Yes, and that's a very good point. That's nicely put. Thank you for reminding us of that, because people forget. With all this talk about us living in a so-called secular society, that our unwritten constitution is still the Queen in Parliament under God. It's not simply elected members to the House of Commons. It's not all simply Parliament. It's the Queen in Parliament under God. And one of the ways, of course, that is symbolised is that Parliament begins every day with prayers. And that's an important symbol, I think, that the people there are ultimately accountable, not only to the people who've elected them, but beyond that, to the one to whom we are all ultimately accountable.
But just briefly, because we've got to pause for some travel news in a moment, Richard. I was speaking to someone from a church in Birmingham yesterday. We're part of a campaign at Premier called Promise to Vote, and, yeah. and we're sending out yeah.
Good.
Details
well
to churches.
Done. Excellent.
And we want the Parliament to yes. know that Christians will be voting. Yes. But I spoke to this minister, and he said, well, I'm not voting. He said, all politicians are crooks and liars. I was yeah. quite shocked. Here's a leader of a church saying
yes.
this.
Yes.
I mean, that's how far we've fallen for
yeah,
some people.
It is how far we've fallen. And it's very sad to hear that, particularly, if I might say so, from a minister, because you could say, well, we get the politicians we deserve. There are terrible things that have happened in Parliament caused by some MPs, but I mean, I like to remind people, they're the people we've elected, and in a way Parliament is a mirror to our society. You know, the kind of fiddling of expenses that if it went on in Parliament, you know, you can't say that society as a whole is totally free of that
Absolutely.
Kind of thing.
Mm.
Anyway, we can come on to that perhaps later on, because
yes,
I know
indeed.
You want to get on with some. But because one of the things I'm very keen on the book is to try to distinguish between the legal and the moral.
Okay.
And you know, what is legal is not necessarily moral.
And we're talking politics this morning. What piece of legislation would you pass if you became an MP or even the PM tomorrow? We've had some fascinating calls already, and John is on the phone.
Hello, John.
Good morning.
Good yeah. morning. How are you doing, John?
I'm okay, thank you. Actually, funny enough, I'm not usually awake this time of the morning. Somebody told me to get up and put the radio on just as you was opening the lines to this competition.
Oh, okay.
Oh, there we go. And what pops into your head? What piece of legislation would you pass?
Gambling. I don't really think people take any notice of how much gamble advertising alone there is in Britain today. The basic way of their advertising gambling is for the internet. It's just an open sea for anybody, especially youngsters. There's no real age restriction, as much as they say there is. Who really knows who's doing what? And, I mean, my son himself has become addicted to scratch cards, and he's only 17.
Oh,
and by the time he's finished, he's really not got much money left in his pocket. Although he works, you know, he doesn't really see much of it. And I've sat him down and I've tried to explain to him, you know, that not only the odds on the winning, but where it leads, because I myself are an ex-gambler, and I was a serious gambler. And I wasn't casinos or anything like that. It was just small-time gambling shops up the town centre. But when you're addicted, you don't know when enough is enough.
Well, will passing a law, John, solve this, or is it something else that's going to solve this?
Well, at the end of the day, it's up to the individual what they choose to do. But when you pass the law, I mean, I believe some
inspirational breakfast.
Not, you know, what's legal is not necessarily moral. But one of the things that stops people doing from things they shouldn't is the fact that there are consequences.
Right.
And people don't think of the consequences spiritually. They do think of consequences within the law. And although it wouldn't cut it all together, it would minimise it. And at the very least, if we could ban advertising, as they have done with cigarettes, and I believe they should do with alcohol, it's a slow process like anything in life. But you do eventually get there. And if it just stops one person, one youngster, from turning out how I used to be and losing the things that I lost,
right,
then that's a total success.
Well, yeah. you've got some wisdom to be able to help your son at least, Esther.
Fascinating stuff. John,
yeah.
Did you say this is the first time you've tuned into Premier?
I've been listening to you for the last 5 or 6 days.
All right.
I live on my own now. I separated from my wife. I moved into a new home, and I thought, you know, give up the telly. I like the music sort of stuff. And I came across you by accident. I've never heard of you before.
Oh, well, bless you.
And so I gave you a listen, and I was so enthralled by what I heard that every morning now, and usually 3 or 4 in the morning, when I wake up, you're the only station I'll listen to.
Oh,
John, you're
thank
a
you
star
very much.
Listener.
Thank you made
you.
That morning.
Thank you
That's
very
a,
much indeed.
A wonderful
well,
compliment.
And thank you for sharing your thought. Separating the legal from the moral, Richard.
Yes, I think he was making some wonderful points. First of all, people don't realise what a serious issue addictive gambling is. It's a very, very serious issue. Secondly, I think that his suggestion that we need a government-sponsored advertising campaign akin to the one against smoking is perhaps the best way. Because in a free society, there's a limit to the number of laws you can pass stopping people doing things, but we can have advertising campaigns and government money can go into it. But he's absolutely right. The legal is not the same as the moral. In the recent sort of parliamentary scandal, all the MPs claimed that what they did was legal. And it was for most of them. It was. It was well within the rules of the time. But it seems to me that the question you need to ask is, was it honourable? Mm. Was it decent? And when it all appeared in the newspapers, the great British public thought, well, this wasn't honourable. This wasn't decent. And I think as a society as a whole, we need to recover a kind of moral environment. So that we no longer think that, well, if we can just get inside the law, that's enough.
And of course, in your book, you're talking about how if we get back to the sort of and recognise the Christian values at the heart of our political system, that might change things. But how do we tap back in? How will you get, 600 MPs, some of whom are passionate Christians, many of whom are not, and many that the culture seems to be against sort of declaring any personal faith. How are we going to get back to these roots?
Yeah, I mean, you make an interesting point. There are a surprising number of practicing religious believers in politics. Again, you know, people say we live in a secular society, but actually if you look through the Commons and the law, there's a surprising number of people who are religious people are in politics because they think this is a way of serving society. It's a question of a change of culture. I mean, no law by itself is going to do the trick, and it's not just Parliament, it's all of us. Actually, I think that there are some signs now that the underlying values of our culture are beginning to shift. And after all, you see, the value which has dominated our society for the last 50, 60 years, to the exclusion of everything else, is the stress on individual free choice. Now, that's a good thing. We all want to respect people's choices, but it works for the market. People must buy what they want when they want, and it works in social life. They have their own lifestyle. Nobody else will interfere. Now, that's all very well up to a point, but the recent Reith lectures by Michael Sandel were absolutely brilliant. They showed that a society actually can't live on that basis alone. If we got time, I'll just give you one of his very vivid examples. In Germany, it's a very horrifying. In Germany, somebody advertised for somebody who'd be willing to be cooked and eaten.
I remember this case.
Yeah, 200 people applied, really? 4 were interviewed, and 1 was duly cooked and eaten. The German authorities found that they couldn't get the person on murder, though they did get them on another charge. But what this showed, you see, it was totally consensual. It was an advert. You didn't have to answer the advert. You didn't have to go. Totally, nothing wrong. If you only think that free choice is the only value that matters, what was wrong with that? They chose to do it. And what this reveals, the sort of sense of horror we all feel that, actually society wants to be characterised by more than the value of free choice. There are certain things which are decent, certain things which are good, and we need to begin to recover a sense that there are these other values as well.
What's gone so wrong in the past few years with politics? Have we just simply drifted? Haven't there been... I mean, part of the idea of having a bishops in the House of Lords was to give, I imagine, a moral backbone to the House of Westminster.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that the bishops are there with sort of claiming the moral high ground to the exclusion of others. No, there are a lot of very, very good people. Let's not exaggerate the role of bishops in the House of Lords. They're there, and they have an important symbolic point, and I think their presence there is valued by other members of, but lots of very, very good people in the Lords, lots of very deeply practicing religious people.
So Christian, how have we drifted from those moral values? I mean, or isn't there any simple explanation?
Well, I don't. There's no one overriding explanation. I mean, the kind of world in which I grew up, you know, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, was a totally, totally different world. That old world went in the 1960s. I lived through the 1960s with young people. It was an amazing time. People who didn't live through it didn't really. No, you know the old adage, if you remember what happened in the 60s, we weren't living through it because everybody was absolutely blown out of their mind. Yeah. It was an amazing time where champagne, corks from champagne bottles were kicking off. It was a time of Carnaby Street, sex, drugs, the Beatles, a whole change of new legislation. Homosexuality was no longer a criminal offence, the abortion law reform, and so on and so on. That's what loosened up our whole set. Now, a lot of that was good. We wouldn't want to go back on that. But in a way, we're still trying to recover, I think, a sense of discrimination, what we want to keep from that great explosion in the 1960s, and actually what we need to recover from that rather more staid world of the 1950s.
Okay. So a new culture for a new age, perhaps.
Hi, it's Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm proud to say we are celebrating our 60th anniversary. From our beginnings as Buzz in the 1960s to the vibrant multi-platform magazine we are today, our commitment to connecting faith with the world around us has never changed. To mark the occasion, we have a special offer of 12 months for half price. That's just £24 for print and digital access. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com. Automatically renews at £47.99.
Okay, we're just going to pause for a moment or two. The voice of Lord Harris, former Bishop of Oxford, we're talking about his new book, Faith in Politics. Very good it is too, as well. Great detail, and I had to sit and read lines time after time sometimes to get them into my little brain. But
It's easy. It's a good read. Good, easy read. It is a good read. Very accessible. Let me just put people off.
No, I'm not putting people off. What I'm saying is I wouldn't have read it time again had I not been intrigued to right. understand what you were getting at. And normal people with better brains than me will say, fascinating stuff.
A good nourishing
stuff.
Read.
A good nourishing read.
We're talking to Lord Harris, a former Bishop of Oxford, whose book Faith in Politics looks at rediscovering the Christian values at the heart of the system. And we're asking you, if you became an MP or even PM tomorrow, what legislation would you pass? That's our breakfast challenge. And we've got Mrs. C on the phone.
She's in North London. Hello, Mrs. C.
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
You sound very intriguing.
I just want to put my ideas across. I would definitely make a change at schools and university and colleges, that the word of God will be preached and that the children will know God, because the word of God is God. That's the only way we change the nation in Great Britain. There will be changes coming, but the only way is to teach the children the ways of God.
So how would you do that? Through RE lessons or through worship?
Yes, everything. Every day in the morning, they will just gather together, assemble together, teach them the word of God, show them the way, and that Jesus is the only way, and that he gives satisfaction to the soul. And that they will not go to addiction or to money-loving ways or whatever.
Well, how do you handle that if the head teacher is a Muslim, for example?
Jesus died for everyone on earth, and everyone on earth need to hear the word of God and the good news. And so it's okay, because Great Britain is a Christian country, and we want to show them the way, and we want to speak the truth in love and teach everyone else. Yes. So for the children, that's the only thing. The children at school, they need to know the way, and Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life.
All right, bless you.
Radical suggestion.
That leads us neatly back to Lord Harris, as we ask, is such a thing possible? Can you legislate Christianity back into the nation in some way?
Well, we have to face the fact that although we are culturally and historically a Christian country, we now have a society which includes many members of other faiths. Last night, for instance, in Parliament, I went to a great gathering of the Sikh community. The Sikh community is very, very large in this country, making a very significant contribution to it. There are 1.5 million Muslims in this country. There's a long-established, smaller Jewish community. And it seems to me a fundamental part of the Christian faith that you actually respect other people where they are and what their beliefs are, and in the kind of society which we live now, you cannot simply impose one religion on everybody all the time. What I do think is that it is an essential part of people's education that they should know something about our Christian heritage and Christian belief. And one of the sad things, of course, about schooling at the moment is people come out totally ignorant of so many schools of, some of the things which are absolutely basic to our culture. I mean, you ask people what Easter is about, and 50% of people don't know. Well, everybody in the country ought to know what Easter is about. It's part of our cultural heritage, whether you're a Muslim or a Sikh, you ought to know that.
So to connect back within that. And of course we've got the interfaith debate, but increasingly, of course, there's a large atheist voice in the country. It's very vocal and creative.
Absolutely.
You're going to be taking part in a debate on April 13th with the author Philip Pullman about his controversial work, a book called The Good Man Jesus and The Scoundrel Christ. Now, what's all that about, and why are you taking part in the debate?
Well, I'm a great admirer of Philip Pullman as a writer, and I do know him a bit. I think he has a great feel for children, and he writes very, very, very well.
Very creative, isn't he? Incredibly creative.
Yes, yeah. And he really understands adolescence, and I think that's wonderful. I mean, I know his Dark Materials book quite well, but the publishers haven't yet unembargoed this present book, so
it's
I'm hot property. I'm hoping to get it today. But I know I'll be very interested to take in that faith, because so many people in our society draw a contrast between Jesus, whom they say they admire, and what St. Paul and the other apostles made of him. They draw a contrast between Jesus and the Christ. And I think that you can't draw that total contrast. So what I'd be interested to talk to Philip Pullman about is that you can't simply treat Jesus as an ordinary good human being, because he said certain things which didn't fit into the ordinary categories. And then, of course, you have the extraordinary experience of St. Paul and the other apostles. They claimed that they'd met or had encountered a risen Christ. And that, of course, made them look at Jesus again with totally new eyes.
Do you think Christians should read this kind of book? Is it helpful, or will it disturb some Christians?
Well, I think the point of reading a book is, first of all, if it's well written, if it's a good book. I can only speak about Philip Pullman's Dark Materials trilogy, but I felt that was a wonderful read, and as I said, it had a great sense of what it is to be a teenager, and a very strong moral vision, not a Christian vision. And I think it's important for us Christians to realise that other people sometimes have a moral vision which is partly good and in part challenging to a Christian moral vision. And if we're going to engage with people in society, we have to, as it were, be on the borderlands and experience both worlds.
Yeah, and are such debates helpful in the end, or do they just simply raise hackles on both sides?
Well, do you know, that's a good question, because I'm beginning to wonder about the usefulness of the... I think the debate with Philip Pullman will be useful, but, I mean, all the sort of debates with Christopher Hitchens and Dawkins and all this, I think really they've really served their time now. And it's interesting that a leading member of the sort of secular humanists said to me not long ago, surely we ought to be kind of cooperating on, you know, certain fundamental values in which we believe. And I'm that's lingered in my mind. I wondered really whether some of the atheists who have a strong moral vision shouldn't actually be more cooperating with Christians to try to recover a much richer and deeper sense of values in our society.
Yes,
because that's the crying need, actually, at the moment.
A certain amount of theological debate and disagreement is helpful, because it helps you think through what you believe and hear other points of view. But there does, it's a fine line, isn't it? There does come a point when it just becomes... argument.
And some of these debates can be simply polemical, and people are scoring debating points. I can take part in some of the debates with people, and it really annoys me, because they're in there to win the applause of a popular audience.
Rather than really tease out
the issues, and that can be rather irritating.
I suppose in some ways that those debates and even books like Philip Pullman's, controversial though they may be, in some ways they may also inspire people who wouldn't have read the Bible to return to the Bible to find out what the source material says. Do you think?
No, I do. And I think that with the title of Philip Pullman's book, it's a very intriguing title. It might indeed encourage people to look at the Gospels and see what kind of person this Jesus was, what the Gospels actually say about him.
And talking about source material, is it time for us in Britain to get back to the roots of what our Parliament and what our system is all about, as indeed you have done in Faith in Politics, and you know, have a complete rethink of the way we run things. It looks as if we may be heading for a hung parliament. People are beginning to lose faith in our first-past-the-post system. Even the Labour Party is suggesting now that maybe we need to have some kind of proportional representation. And I know in certain areas, if you vote a certain way, it's a completely wasted vote because three-quarters of the people are voting another way. Do we need to rethink it all?
Well, we certainly need to think very seriously how we can reconnect the population as a whole with our political representatives. At the moment, there's a gap. The turnout figures for elections are appallingly low. And you contrast that with the time when apartheid came to an end in South Africa.
Indeed.
And we saw these moving queues of people who would walk for a day and then queue for half a day in order to vote. We need to try to bring about a new sense in our society that actually politics matters. It matters who you elect, and that we should all have much more of a stake in it.
And it's quite interesting, just briefly, haven't got lots of time now, but I suppose we're seeing a little bit of that in America at the moment, aren't we, with all the sort of excitement surrounding Barack Obama and his year of presidency, and he talks differently about faith. So that's changing things in American politics. Do we need the same thing over here? Do we need an Obama over here?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that is very, very interesting, because Barack Obama made no apology for bringing his faith and faith-based values into the public sphere. Mm. You see, in the past, so many liberals like him would have said, politics is only about the things we have in common. You've got to confine your faith to your private life. Obama said no. You know, we're bringing this out into the public sphere. As we know, he got elected. Wonderful. Yeah. But he does it in a way which is not oppressive, not moralistic.
A very different approach from George W.
Yes, a very different approach from George W. But Michael Sandel, in that book that I read early, he particularly criticises liberals for trying to keep their idea of the good as a private thing. And what he says, it's a very telling phrase. He says, "Fundamentalists rush in where liberals fear to tread." Well, you know, if liberals are worried about moralistic right-wing people dominating the public debate, get in themselves. Barack Obama got in with his Christian values, which are different Christian values from those of George W. Bush.
And what a great way to end our morning with you, to a call to engage, really, isn't it?
Absolutely.
To get involved.
Yeah.
The book is simply called Faith in Politics and...
with a question mark.
With a
Faith
question
in
mark.
Question mark.
That was the late Lord Richard Harries speaking to us here at Premier. That interview was recorded on the Inspirational Breakfast Show, hosted by John Pantry and Esther Higham.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity magazine.